Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. It's the Roundtable on the Roundtable. We have a wonderful panel before us. Ray Graff is here. Good morning, Raymond.
Hello.
good morning. David Gustina is with us, our morning edition host.
Good morning.
You have much more enthusiasm than Ray does. I mean, not that it's a contest.
It's a different kind of enthusiasm.
Have any of you ever had that dream where you are... you walk into the room of the class to take the final exam and realize that you had never, you've never been to any of the classes or nothing.
Yeah.
Have you ever had that? Like,
I don't call that a dream. I call that a memory.
Right.
Okay.
But, let's say it's been a few years, you've been out of school, and you still have that kind of recurring thing.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm living that right now. Walking into the studio. I just feel ill prepared.
No.
You know, one of those things. We have a here's what happened. We have a Rosemary Mayo.
Yes.
The wonderful Rosemary Mayo, University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter, was to be on our panel this morning. And so because she is brilliant and because we love her, we chose several topics to discuss with her. Well,
yes.
Here's what happened. So what she was going to do is she was going to do the media project, and then she was going to come in and do our show at 9 o'clock. Well, the taping of the media project got delayed because the fancy new press at the Times Union that we talked about on Tuesday broke. So
the ripple effects. Yeah,
is it fixed?
Yeah,
I see Rex is in the house.
He's here and
house.
It is fixed, but
good.
It was apparently a trying evening.
Yeah, so they had. I don't think it's been a great day for Rex.
No. Well, if you think about it now. When we went to digital, 13 years ago, we had all sorts of issues the first year or two.
Well, absolutely.
Indeed.
You can't, and hopefully it won't take that long.
No, I'm kidding. But the first few weeks were dicey. Things would disappear and,
And a fellow publisher, the great Ira Fussfeld, was saying, when they had their press, that it takes a little while for it
growing
to get.
Pains.
Yeah, that's absolutely so. It's an interesting story. Anyway, so we have topics that we want to talk about. There's some really interesting things. So I'm sort of gonna move things around a little bit, other than what we had, because I want to wait till Rosemary comes in. But one of the issues, of course, the big issue of the day is that, hey, we have a budget.
We do.
We have a budget.
Although they're still
New York
negotiating
State.
Some pieces of it.
So how does that work?
Well, it's an interesting point, Joe. Basically, what we're seeing is that the governor and legislative leaders are continuing talks today. They're looking at some non-budget issues, things like marijuana decriminalization, SAFE Act amendments. And at the same time, they're saying they have a framework of a deal in place. The way I understand it is they may break today, go away, come back this weekend, and vote on the bills.
Yeah.
So it's what they call a conceptual budget agreement.
Right.
But several key details in the spending plan are still not settled, and items that are being simultaneously negotiated, which, as you mentioned, David, marijuana laws, but also the state's gun control laws are also resolved. And but hey, most of the details that the lawmakers did confirm came out of this closed-door budget negotiations. And so finally, when you see the white smoke and you say, okay, we have a budget, that's a good thing. I think for all of us in this room who have been covering this story for years, for the idea for a budget to happen in March is somewhat unheard of. And yet in democracy, it's what we ultimately expect.
Well, and it's been a couple of good years in a row.
Yeah, absolutely.
There were some bad years.
Yeah.
Is that
how we're referring to them?
Well,
yeah,
slow.
The bad years.
Well, it used to be that the governor would come out with a budget number, the Senate and the Assembly would come out with their numbers, the comptroller would come out with a number, and then everyone would fight for a very long time and blame each other. And the last few years, 3 years, we've seen on-time budgets. But at the same time, when you look at the process, in terms of three men in a room, let's say, maybe legislators not reading all of the legislation because they're passing it rapidly overnight, those things still seem to exist.
Right. And, you know, because of the, I would assume, again, I'm just, you know, speculating, but I you would assume that because of the backlash over the gun proposal and not having that 3-day waiting period on bills, that now that you have this conceptual agreement that was reached in the wee hours of this morning, that, as you mentioned, David, that lawmakers had been scheduled to leave the Capitol at the end of today, then go on a 3-week break, and they thought everybody, you know, it would be done by then. Well, it wasn't. So now that pushes it into Saturday with a hope that lawmakers will wrap up on Monday and will still be able to have their 3-week break for the holidays. So
for Cancun. Legislators gone wild. Yes.
Oh, Ray, you always put a spin on it.
And the minimum wage seems to have gone through here, right? So that's happening.
We've been talking a lot about the minimum wage, and the best guess all the way along was $9.
Yes.
And that is what we've ended up with. Minimum wage will rise from $7.25 to $9 an hour in 3 steps, with the top step kicking in on or just before January 1st, 2016, better known as 2.5 years away.
Right.
So,
also some tax breaks. Some families with children will be getting $350 checks in New York, right?
We'll spend $350 million to send $350 rebate checks for homeowners with a dependent child under 18.
Now, I saw. What are you looking at me for?
You're the only one with a dependent child in this room under 18.
I saw.
Do cats count?
In the Syracuse paper this morning, that number, according to their headline, was between 350 and 500.
Interesting.
So I'm hoping, you know, for a little more.
The check's in the mail, Raymond.
How many do you have under 18? None of them are 18?
No. They're barely 10.
Wow.
So, yeah.
It's amazing. You're as patient as you are. Did you hear that story on Marketplace just a little bit ago about the number one distraction in the car? The people, you know, talking about texting, talking about the radio, the number one distraction in the car is
with
children.
Children, yeah.
I thought of
it. Don't make
Ray.
Me pull this car over. No comment.
You don't find that? Do you find that distracting as a driver?
You know, I don't want to see any emails from management, so I have no comment on this. We'll just move on.
When you think about the budget agreement, it makes you think of what we're doing here in New York. It makes you think of also on the federal level. Obviously, they have put spending in place that our bills apparently will be paid as a nation at least through September, and it's funny that I think we talk about a culture in this country where we have trouble figuring out our own finances, but we don't really have many good role models in that regard. You know, it's like it doesn't seem that anybody can get their act together when it comes to coming up with a budget and spending the way we should.
That's
spend.
That's because debt is a killer. When you have to move things around all the time to pay your bills, it's not easy, and that's what the state, feds, everybody has to deal with.
Right, and we don't have a government that allows us to. Meaning the three of us don't have, you know, another nation we can go to get money from.
Certainly not Cyprus.
Yes, yes, but we're not limited in what we can take out from our ATMs by the government.
Absolutely. We would love to have you join us and email us roundtable@wamc.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page or by tweeting us at WAMC Roundtable. We would love to have you join in on the conversation. Roundtable@wamc.org. You can comment on our webpage or Facebook page or by tweeting us at WAMC Roundtable. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.
Support comes from Lewis Signs, offering electronic signs, vehicle wraps, and storefront signage for 89 years. Tell the world with signs. LewisSigns.com. And Smith College Museum of Art, presenting Collecting Art of Asia, a 4-part exhibition celebrating 100 years of Asian art at Smith, from traditional to contemporary. Now on view, smith.edu/artmuseum.
when we talk about comment, or when we talk about topics that we want to talk about in the show, we obviously try to have a mix of things that are national and regional and things that reverberate to all of our listeners throughout the seven states that we broadcast to. When you find a story like this story I'm about to talk about, it is fascinating because this is obviously a very local story that has national and even entertainment reverberations, and it's a fascinating story. I'm going to read quickly from the Hollywood Reporter, of all places. In a development that could reverberate throughout the entertainment industry, a New York Supreme Court judge has taken the bold step of enjoining the broadcast of Lifetime Television's telefilm Romeo Killer, the Christopher Porco story, which was scheduled to air on Saturday. Mm-hmm. The film is based on the true story of the murder of Peter Porco and the attempted murder of his wife, Joan, the resulting criminal investigation, and the prosecution and conviction of their son, Christopher Porco, for those crimes. The case drew national news attention, and Lifetime's planned film drew a lawsuit from the convicted killer, who alleges that Romeo Killer violates his rights. On Tuesday, Judge Robert Mueller issued an injunction that not only prevents the airing, but also prohibits Lifetime from promoting the film, which stars Matt Barr as Chris Porco and Eric McCormick of Will and Grace fame as the case's lead detective. In reaction, Lifetime is filing an emergency application to vacate or stay the injunction on appeal. According to court documents, the cable network says it stands to lose more than $1 million if not given immediate appellate relief. So what is fascinating about this is that you have a man who is in jail for who is convicted of axe murder and is saying, you're violating my rights. And for me, this is a tricky one, because while we so often have heard cases of people in prison who are trying to, in some way, are trying to profit from the crimes that they've committed in writing books or telling stories or however the case may be, here you have someone who says, look, this is my story and you can't do anything. We're not allowing you to do anything with this.
But, you know, if you look at the wording of it, I think that, really, I mean, if they had thrown him a couple of bucks, it's a different story. Because I from what I can see from his complaint or what the judge said, they're using his likeness, et cetera, without compensation.
He has sued Lifetime, claiming that the film violated New York Civil Rights Section 51, the state's version of publicity rights, which allows a person to seek redress if his or her name, portrait, picture, or voice is used for advertising purposes or for the purposes of trade without the written consent first obtained.
Right.
The jailed killer, who has not seen Romeo Killer, alleged that the movie was a substantially fictionalized account about plaintiff and the events that led to his incarceration. Lifetime counters that the essential elements of the movie are true and accurate and based on court and police records, interviews with persons involved, and historical and other documents. Lifetime is saying, look, the story's been told in 48 Hours Mystery. It's been told on True TV series Forensic Files. So what makes this different? And I guess that's the question that the court, and I was surprised that the court acted in the way that it did.
Is it because it's dramatized or fictional? Is this the point, that it's fictionalized in some way, or is that what the argument
is? He continues to maintain his innocence. And, you know, I think in a statement he said, you know, we're still appealing this, or maybe in his argument to the court, he said, we're still appealing this, but it went to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court not going to touch it. So I think those appeals are done, as far as I can understand. So I'm not sure what the beef is here, other than I suspect, you know, if they had said, we're going to use your likeness, will give money to you, the victims will get it or whatever, it might be a different story.
And I don't know, but do we assume that this might be standard procedure in the way these things work or not? I mean, is this a way of, you know,
well,
okay, now we get the money and that's how it gets resolved?
Lifetime is saying that the Supreme Court's order is unprecedented and would cause grave and irreparable damage, not just to Lifetime, but to the constitutional protections for speech. And how many of these cases, how many of these movies have we seen about famous cases?
Sure.
And so what makes this different, I'm not really sure, in the sense of, okay, we're going to do a fictionalized account of I was going to say marquee, but hopefully people understand what I mean. A case that has gained national
attention.
Like O.J.
Simpson.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And you can take it one step further and say, okay, well, you know, we as a film-going public, you take a film like Zero Dark Thirty that has to do with the killing of Osama bin Laden, and a film that I love, by the way, that you take that film, you tell that story. It is, by all counts, a fictionalization, but we're using very real events.
But are you using real people's names? I did not see that picture.
Well, I mean, in some cases, yes, and in some cases,
okay.
No. I mean, obviously, you're using Osama bin Laden's name.
Right.
So they're in some cases yes, in some cases no. But it's an interesting question is how far you can take it. I'll take it one step further and just throw it out to you guys. But I mean, having lived in this region and lived through that story, and you know the people involved. I mean, it's sort of the last thing I want to see a dramatization.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you know, it's
just Shakespearean tragedy on that level is what this story is about.
I mean, it's just, no matter who is innocent or guilty, I don't know. But either way you look at it, a man was killed with an axe,
yeah.
And it's a sad story.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we can suspect who's guilty because he has been found guilty.
Right.
So we can say.
Absolutely.
He's guilty.
But it is, but by the same token, but again, you know, appealing and still maintaining his innocence, and whatever the case may be, in this issue, it is still a question of, you know, is that entertainment? Is that something then that you want to watch in a dramatization? But it's
not something I want to see. Although I do think Lifetime, to some extent, doth protest too much. In other words, all this publicity. You have a fair shot that this will be overturned quickly. This is a shot in the arm for their viewership and the number of people who now know about this movie. I mean, I don't know anything that's on Lifetime. This is the first thing I've heard that's on Lifetime, you know, in years.
And you add controversy into it.
Yeah.
More people tune in.
After this, again, this is from the Hollywood Reporter article, but after spending $2 million to acquire the rights to the film and nearly $1 million to promote the movie as appointment viewing, their term.
Okay.
Lifetime says an injunction would have a devastating financial and reputational impact on the network that it will lead to a reluctance among cable affiliates and advertisers to spend money on Lifetime. The TV viewers will come to see Lifetime as unreliable and not trustworthy. We would love to know what you think about all of this. You can certainly weigh in. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page or by tweeting us at WAMC Roundtable. Ray Graff is on our panel. David Gustina is here as well. Rosemary Armeo is joining us in just moments. We're going to take a quick break for the news, and we'll be back. You're listening to the Roundtable on the Roundtable on WAMC.
Support comes from the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, protecting New York's historic buildings, districts, and landscapes since 1974. PreserveNYS.org. New England Hydroponics on Route 10 in Southampton, Massachusetts, helping people bring plants to life since 2002, offering hydroponic supplies and indoor lighting for plants. NEHydro.com. And 10,000 Villages in Stuyvesant Plaza, Albany, and on Main Street in Northampton, featuring fairly traded home decor and gifts handcrafted by artisans around the world. 10,000villages.com.
There was a time when local and regional news was a foundation of radio, but that time has sadly passed, except at WAMC. I'm Brian Shields. WAMC is committed to full regional and local coverage with a full staff of reporters, producers, and bureau chiefs. While others have left that type of reporting behind, WAMC has not and will not. Become a member today at WAMC.org or by calling 800 323-9262. If you hear something, give something.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tappert Brothers, here with a time-honored way to dispose of your car.
It's fast, reliable, and takes just one phone call.
It's the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program.
Oh, I thought we were talking about a fire.
No. You get a tax deduction, and your station gets the proceeds. Call 1-866-789-TMCP.
TMCP?
Yeah, take my car, please.
That's 866-789-8627.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jean Cochran. President Obama has been urging Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas to restart the peace process with Israel. At a joint news conference in Ramallah, President Obama said a Mideast peace with two independent states is still possible, although difficult to achieve.
We cannot give up on the search for peace. Too much is at stake.
President Obama says he's told Israeli leaders the U.S. does not consider settlement activity in the West Bank to be constructive, nor, he said, does it advance the cause of peace. But the president suggests the Palestinians not make it a condition of resuming peace negotiations with Israel. President Obama was in Jerusalem earlier today when two rockets fired from Gaza exploded in southern Israel. Linda Gradstein reports.
Israeli police said one of the rockets damaged a backyard in the Israeli town of Sderot and the other exploded in an open area. The rockets were seen as a message to President Obama, who was on the second day of a three-day visit to Israel and the West Bank. Analysts said Israel is not expected to respond to the rocket fire while the president is visiting. There have been almost no rockets fired since Israel and Hamas reached a ceasefire last November. For NPR News, I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The labor market continues to improve. Even though last week claims for unemployment benefits ticked upward slightly, the average over the past month shows they have reached a new five-year low. Economist Gus Fauché says it's the average that tells the story.
And the fact that that is at its lowest point since early 2008, certainly that's an indication that the labor market is really creating jobs at a pretty rapid clip, and that we should see some good employment numbers for March when we get those in early April.
The four-week average has fallen nearly 15% since November as the job market has accelerated. In the opening bell on Wall Street, though, the Dow's down 64 points. For several years, the CIA has been in charge of the drone program, using unmanned aircraft to target and kill suspected terrorists. But NPR's Tom Gelton reports the administration's now considering handing control to the Pentagon.
A senior U.S. official says there is a distinct possibility the drone program will shift in phases from the CIA to the Pentagon. Such a move would subject the program to new legal restrictions and more scrutiny. Under U.S. law, military operations must be carried out under the regular chain of command, while CIA operations can be covert and deniable. The drone program has proven increasingly controversial, with members of Congress demanding that the Obama administration be more open about where, when, and against whom drones can be used. Putting drones under the Pentagon's authority would also underscore how conventional their use has become, with combat operations increasingly carried out under remote control. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. In northwestern Pakistan, a bomb blast tore through part of a refugee camp as hundreds of people were lined up to get food. At least a dozen deaths are reported. Investigators don't know yet why Colorado Corrections Department head Tom Clements was fatally shot at his home Tuesday night as he answered his front door. El Paso County Lieutenant Jeff Kramer says they're looking into the possibility it may be connected to Clements' decision to deny a request from a Saudi national prisoner to serve out the remainder of his sentence in Saudi Arabia.
However, we also remain open-minded to all of the other possibilities as well, because we don't want to follow one particular trail and find ourselves perhaps missing something along the way.
Security's been stepped up for state officials in Colorado, including Governor John Hickenlooper. The shooting came just hours before Hickenlooper signed into law Colorado's first new gun restrictions in decades. Five people have been killed in 2 days of rioting in central Myanmar, also known as Burma. A mosque has been burned.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports there's concern the violence between Muslims and majority Buddhists may spread.
Burmese media report that the riots were sparked by an argument Wednesday at a gold shop owned by Muslims in the town of Mektila. That's about 330 miles north of Yangon, Myanmar's largest city. Several units of riot police have been deployed to Mektila. Pro-democracy activists are reportedly headed there, too, to try to mediate and cool sectarian tensions. Relations between Muslims and Buddhists have been uneasy since violence flared last year in western Rakhine State, forcing thousands of ethnic Rohingya Muslims to flee the country. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Jakarta.
I'm Jean Cochran, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Candida Fund, supporting the National Parks Conservation Association, working to ensure that America's national parks are well-funded and well-managed.
Support comes from Times Union Center, Albany, New York, presenting Andrea Bocelli performing songs from his upcoming album, Passione, Thursday, June 13th at 7:30 p.m. TimesUnionCenter-Albany.com. And American Meditation Institute, Averill Park, New York, offering meditation classes for beginners working to reduce stress and enhance their health. AmericanMeditation.org.
This is Capital Region Bureau Chief Dave Lucas. Today on Midday Magazine, New York State has a new agreement with Israel aimed at increasing collaboration on nanotechnology research. I was at the College of Nanoscale Science and Engineering in Albany when the announcement was made. I'll have more for you from Lieutenant Governor Bob Duffy and CNSC's Elaine Kelleros. State officials say the agreement will enable billions of dollars in investments and create new high-tech jobs in New York and Israel. That's today at noon on Midday Magazine with Brian Shields here on WAMC.
Menacing music.
Yes.
Yeah. Whoa.
Well, Rosemary's here.
Well, hello.
Yeah. Da.
So it's a roundtable on the roundtable, and WAMC's Ray Graff is here. Good morning, Ray.
Hello.
WAMC is a morning edition host. David Castina joins
hello.
Us. And new to our panel today, she's been on the panel before, of course,
yes.
but was
yeah, I like
busy.
Talking to you guys.
Was busy doing the media project.
I was busy, and I missed some of the discussion on Chris Porco. I have to drag you back into that for a minute.
You certainly can do that.
Okay, so yeah. Why is he the Romeo killer, the name
that,
of this book?
Love,
why
love
is he
too.
The Romeo
yeah,
killer?
Yeah, we don't really know. We don't really understand that.
Okay.
Nor do we. And now the one thing that you said when you came in that I didn't react to because I wanted to save it for the air. And that was we had just said that we didn't want to see the film because we had lived through it. But you, the first thing.
I totally want to see it.
Tell us what you really think.
Oh, my God.
Rosemary.
This is like O.J. Simpson. I want to see everything. I want to read every version. Local mystery writer, my friend Vin Zandri, is working on a book that's based, you know, loosely or not so loosely on the Porco. I think it's fascinating. Maybe it's because I have a son. I have sons. The idea of their chopping me to death in the middle of the night is kind of horrifying. I would like to see this. And I don't understand what in the First Amendment allows him to not let us see it. I get it, you know, that he can make some money off of it if we use his name. But so can't we see it and then we figure out if he gets the money or not?
I think it's and you bring up an interesting point and one that we mentioned before, and perhaps you have greater insight to this, but certainly the precedent is there to be dramatizations of big trials.
Sure.
So what makes this different, I guess,
yeah,
is the
exactly.
question. And the thing that we came out of was surprised by the court's decision.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like prior restraint. I don't get it. And I also love the idea of truth and fiction when you're telling so-called real stories. Argo this year, the
Zero Dark Thirty you mentioned.
Zero Dark
Thirty
had the – yeah, exactly. So this seems to be the same order, and I don't want this, you know, this murderer deciding what I get to see.
And that's an interesting way of looking at it, of a murderer getting to decide what you get to view.
I can understand the state of New York not wanting him to profit from the story.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, so let us see it, and then we argue about the money later.
When Ray seemed to think posited that, you know, that this will be overturned, do you think it will be? Do you think ultimately when it comes down to Sunday night it'll air?
Boy, I think it must have to. I hope it's just the court being extra careful. You know, prior restraint is such an unusual thing that even the Pentagon Papers, remember those little things? they aired. The court's decision was, we'll look at it and then we'll decide what we should have been done about it. And that's exactly the way we have always done it. So I'm surprised by this.
Because it was New York's publicity rights law.
Correct. And it isn't technically First Amendment, but it seems like there should have some effect here.
Well, we'll see what happens in the next few days, and obviously Lifetime is challenging the order, so we'll
How quickly can they turn this around on an appeal?
I think pretty quick.
Yeah, you can do it as soon as the court can just say, okay, we're going to decide right now, so they don't have to.
And obviously the film is ready to go. Let's move on to other topics and begin with one that is, I just think, you know, talk about Lifetime movies. You can't make this stuff up. Let's go to South Carolina. So
Appalachian
Sanford.
Trail or?
Wow. Mark
story
Sanford.
That keeps on giving. Jeez.
So Mark Sanford is the former governor of the state of South Carolina. He had a major sex scandal that took him out of office and decided to look for a political comeback and run for Congress. So he runs for Congress and gets the most votes in the GOP field. And there were 16 people running or something. It was an amazing candidates, a list of candidates who were running. And but he didn't get the votes that he needed. He was the top vote getter.
Yeah.
However, he did not receive the 50%, I guess, that you needed to get to be the candidate on the ballot.
Right.
So there will be a runoff. And then there's some question as to who it'll be runoff with, because the second spot seems to be in question. Okay, that to me is good enough. Like that's a
juicy. We get
that's
more
a movie.
Campaigning.
That's a movie in and of itself.
Yeah.
I want the interview with his soon-to-be new wife, the little Argentinian.
His soulmate.
Hey, Argentinians are in the news a lot this week.
Yes,
very much so. And yeah, and look, and what about the ex-wife? I mean, that's fascinating too.
Oh yes.
Okay, so that's a movie. Then, that's its own movie.
Yeah.
Then let's move over to the other movie, which is. If he, whoever wins this, is going to be running against Stephen Colbert's sister.
Terrific.
And that's a great story. So it's a fascinating case. What I wanted to talk to you all about this morning and bring up to the panel for discussion is this idea of political comebacks. I find this issue fascinating. Let us talk about, look at Gary Hart.
Mm-hmm.
1984, Gary Hart's running for president. You know, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Donna Hart, right? Was that her name? Yes.
Yeah, that's it. The monkey business.
Yeah, the monkey business.
Yeah.
And
hard
then
to keep these scandals straight.
And he dared the press to follow him, right?
Yeah, he did.
Right. Look, follow me. I'm clean as a whistle.
And then the Herald did.
And then they did, and they took a picture, and okay. And then down goes his. Yeah. Then down goes the candidate,
so to speak.
Okay, so thank you, Raymond. So then, years later, we look at a president of the United States who is impeached, and who now has some of the highest approval ratings, and
still did at the time, at the end of his presidency,
and we forgive. And we forgive, and we say, okay, we're going to move on. We forgive. And you look at what happened to Mark Sanford, and you say, okay, and I guess ultimately the question I'm getting around to asking is, Do you think we're going to reach a point where if you have a scandal like this, where you say, I was hiking on the Appalachian Trail, oh, no, I was actually having an affair.
Yeah, the wrong triptych.
Or
he's never going to get over the jokes.
Or you're having an affair at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C. Is there a point where that doesn't become a scandal where you don't have to resign your office?
Yes, I think that we are getting to that point. I am frequently puzzled by why some people resign and some don't. Eliot Spitzer resigned way fast, maybe it's because it was criminal, and the president of the United States did not. Clinton did not. I think it was because Clinton had friends and knew he could weather it, whereas Spitzer did not. But ultimately, both have gotten past their transgressions.
Well, what about the society and the mores and, you know, the idea that humans are fallible and we all make mistakes, and when we enter politics suddenly there's a sort of a list of expectations.
But
that,
shouldn't there be?
Let me just finish what I'm saying, which is we should have these expectations, but realistically,
get them right.
Are we hypocrites in the end when we expect we're going to get a perfect, we should have a perfect person?
Want a perfect person. We want someone who we can say, okay, listen, we hold this person to a higher standard. This is not Gustina running the show, although that would be great. I mean, don't get me wrong.
No, it's fine.
But this is somebody that we have voted in, and we say, we're holding you to a higher standard. Please behave yourself
to
some extent.
David's point is interesting in that what our litmus test is at any given time changes. So 20, 30, 40 years ago, if a candidate said, I smoked pot,
right,
we said, okay, well, then you can never run for office.
You're disqualified.
Mm-hmm. President Obama writes in his book 5 years before, you know, here are the drugs I did, and gets it out there, and it's not even an issue.
That's another element. So putting it out there so that we're not surprised by it often has a way of buffering yourself, a way of being forgiven because, quote unquote, you're honest about it from the get-go. And they seem to be always around some sort of personal foible, not necessarily like corruption. You know, we expect our political figures to act in a moral way when it comes to managing finances and their everyday working in the legislature. But when it comes to their personal foibles, I find it interesting that once again, we find out somebody's not perfect and they've done something
and
they regret.
I find my own thinking on this has changed. I was horrified by the goings-on in the Oval Office. I thought it should not have to be written anyplace that no sex in the Oval Office, leave it alone. You know, I didn't think that should be required, and it called into judgment the man who would do such a thing.
But
on
what about when
hand,
FDR? And the way journalists operated in that time.
Same thing, and we have a right to know if our president is crippled or seriously ill. I think that access, we gave away truth in order to have access closer. And Kennedy, you know, his excesses with women were far more dangerous even than Clinton's, because he was going around with mafia women.
Yeah. Right.
I think it's all wrong and bad, and I think the press should always be reporting about it. On the other hand, there are things that we would never call into question that are much worse, like being lied to on weapons of mass destruction. That seemed to be a much more hideous kind of offense than sex in the Oval Office. So it changes my mind. I want some rules about that. And I want the press to write about all of this unendingly.
Yeah. And you look at what's been written, and this is going off topic a little bit, but you look at what the press has written over the in the past week about the 10th anniversary of our war in Iraq. I mean, that narrative is definitely changing.
Right.
Much, much more. And I mean, I think we can all agree in this room that we're of that age now where we can say, you know, 10 years really isn't that long ago. You know,
no.
it's just what has happened in 10 years is really quite incredible of what we have allowed and how we've progressed.
Well, it was fascinating to me when Ronald Reagan died and they began telling the story of his time and the air traffic controllers. That story was different than I remember what was reported. And then it happened with Gerald Ford, the way that the pardon of Richard Nixon came about, and the retelling, the story was different. And I find that nerve-wracking.
Well, yeah.
I want the early memories.
You learn more. I mean, look at the difference between Argo and Zero Dark Thirty.
Right.
Argo, you have 30 years to go back and say, okay, now we've got some of the details. Who knows what we'll know about the Zero Dark 30 things in 10
years. Point.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Going back to Mark Sanford for a moment and saying, okay, we talk about a political comeback, but still, it's only 37% in the sense of, you know, this is a majority when you look at how many people were there, and he certainly had the strongest numbers by a lot.
And name recognition.
But obviously the name recognition helped, but it's by no means a mandate, and it'll be interesting to see
Sanford's also backed by a kind of spooky fundamentalist Christian organization, the 30th Street. They've written about it, and it's the same organization that has worked in places like Africa against homosexual rights. And that makes me nervous that he's coming back pushed by them, their money and their support.
But the fundamentalists are still supporting him? In other words, after
if you read about this group, they believe that you're the powerful and anointed, and the powerful and anointed make mistakes. David made mistakes in the Bible, and they're great, and so therefore, when they have these missteps, we forgive and move on.
Strange bedfellows?
Interesting.
Yeah.
I guess it's ultimately up to the voters if they want to forgive and forget.
You know, we started this off in a lighter tone of talking about a Lifetime movie, but I was saying, you know, you could have a Lifetime movie about Stephen Colbert's sister, Elizabeth Colbert Bush. I mean, my God, have you heard her story?
I don't know her story.
Her father and two of her brothers were killed in a plane crash when she was 19 years old. She was married to a man who ended up on America's Most Wanted. And in 2001, while at a business conference in New York City, she was sitting in a building directly across the street from the World Trade Center and watched the two jetliners slam into the Twin Towers.
Do we really want her in Congress?
Wow, that's a campaign ad.
I mean, you know, this is a woman who has lived through a lot, you know? And so it is, that in and of itself is quite the story and what you've been able to
She's
overcome.
She's like a magnet for disaster. That's horrible. Wait a minute. This is awful.
Thank you.
That's not the way I thought you were going to go with it. I thought you were going to say you have this strong woman who has overcome all of this adversity in her life.
Okay,
and
that
she's...
too.
I like that spin.
That's spooky.
Stay away from her then.
Yeah.
She's bad luck. Get that woman a rabbit's foot.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back and talk about the ever-pressing issue of who should host The Tonight Show. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support comes from the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working to permanently preserve the natural, scenic, and recreational resources of Lake George. Hiking guides, events, and more at lglc.org. The Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center at Vassar College, presenting Recent Acquisitions, Works on Paper, works by Rembrandt, Warhol, and others, through March 30th, fllac.vassar.edu. And Buttermilk Falls Spa, Milton, New York, eco-friendly treatments using organic, naturally crafted products and offering a solar geothermal heated sauna, steam room, and pool. Open daily, buttermilkspa.com.
Welcome back to The Roundtable on The Roundtable. WAMC's Ray Graff is here. David Gastina is here. And Ew. Rosemary Armeo is with us, the Albany University of Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter and, of course, panelist on The Media Project. And it's a delight to have her join us. One of the issues, I had to put this in into our lineup this morning because I'm fascinated by this. I'm always fascinated by the story. I always have been fascinated by the story. I think we can certainly argue that The Tonight Show is not what it was. We had this giant institution when it was with Steve Allen and Jack Parr and of course, Johnny Carson for a 30-plus year reign. And
our kids don't even know who they are.
Nope.
No. And it's – which is, you know – to me, not knowing Carson, and I still, I don't know I don't know about you, but I when things go on, like this Mark Sanford story, would you not love
oh my
to
God.
Hear
oh.
what
so funny.
Johnny Carson has to say about it, and the king of the monologue. So Johnny Carson is, obviously it's a long time since then. Jay Leno takes over, pretty much weasels the job from David Letterman. David Letterman gets upset. He goes on to his own show. He's doing quite well, thank you very much. And then you say, okay, we're going to put Jay Leno on at 10 o'clock. They put Jay Leno at 10 o'clock. And then we're going to make our new host of The Tonight Show, Conan O'Brien. Conan O'Brien has the show for less than a year. Jay Leno's show tanks. And they say, Conan, we don't want you to do the show anymore. Go back to 12:30. And he says, hey, no. So he goes to pay cable. He's doing all right. And you have Jimmy Fallon on at 12:30, and you have Jay Leno back at 11:30 hosting The Tonight Show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now Jay Leno, that he has the show, says, I'm kind of tired.
Yeah.
I'm going to retire.
Now that I got it back.
And so is expected to retire in 2014. So the obvious choice. And
so he's not that tired.
And NBC deciding, okay, well, we want to try to avoid all of the nonsense because we have botched this horribly twice, that maybe we could actually, try to figure this out, says, okay, well, we're going to accept his retirement, and we want to have Jimmy Fallon become the new host of The Tonight Show.
That's a good fit.
Now, here again, a national story with local connections. Jimmy Fallon is a local guy. He went to the College of St. Rose. He is, it's a local boy made good. And the thing I love about this story is not only are they talking, the Los Angeles Times reports this morning, not only are they talking about having Fallon be the new host of The Tonight Show, but that The Tonight Show, for the first time since Carson left New York City in the late 1960s, that the show will be from New York, which I think is a very cool
thing. Now, if they can only make it 90 minutes again, they'd have something.
That's right. Well, they need and they got a great band. They could make it 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then that, of course, takes out the late night show.
But if Jimmy's leaving anyway.
Wait, Doc Severinsen's not there anymore?
Well, yeah.
Well, I would like there to be a woman. I think we should have a woman host. Just get out of this model. It's old.
Who would you
defeat.
Have?
Who's the Silverstone? What's her first name?
Alicia? Oh.
No. You're thinking of the other comedian. She was married to
Sarah Silverman.
Yes.
Sarah Silverman would be great.
They'd have to beep an awful lot.
Yeah, that would be
Margaret
tough.
Margaret Show.
You know, Chelsea Handler has a show, of course. Wanda Sykes has a show. It's
there's not a lack.
No, there isn't.
Elaine Boozler could do it.
No. Now you're really going back right. a long time.
Joan Rivers,
that's right.
Toadie Fields.
Although Joan Rivers is having a resurgence that actually could probably bring in some ratings.
She's fabulous.
Now.
I've watched her reality show. She's and they did a wonderful documentary.
Oh, the documentary was fantastic. Yeah. But
but seriously, how come a woman can't do it?
All right.
I don't know.
You guys have messed it up.
Ruth Buzzy.
but you look at what happened because we accepted Joan Rivers in the role as a guest host for The Tonight Show for years.
Yeah.
And then went off to Fox and said, okay, I'm going to do my own show. Did it. And it was not successful. Johnny Carson, of course, famously just sort of blackballed her.
Right.
And it is an interesting story of, where are we? But do we have someone of that? Because you look at the female comics of today, and there are some wonderful, wonderful comics, of whether it be Amy Schumer being one of them, Lisa Lampanelli being another. I mean, there's some really fantastic Kathy Griffin, great comics out there. But are they ready? Are they ready for prime time? And that is also a question.
Are they ready for prime time? That's
of course, 11:30 is not prime time.
No, that is not. No, I would say
actually, Johnny Carson was a great showcase of new talent.
I do not.
Women.
I want to go back to that because that has nothing to do with women. That has to do with the same question is being said about Howard Stern, who's being talked about as a replacement for Jimmy Fallon. Is he ready for prime time? And by the way, it's not prime time. It's late night.
Exactly.
That's another issue. But
By the way, is Arsenio Hall coming back? Is that happening?
Oh, I don't know.
I thought I heard something like that.
Oh, Ellen DeGeneres. There's
Well, she
one.
Has a show.
Yeah.
And a very successful show.
Oh, look at the time.
We'd love to hear what you have to. So none of you care about that? Anybody like the idea of Fallon hosting the
show? Oh, I love it. Absolutely. Perfect thing.
Better than Leno, right?
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
But not as good as Elaine
Leno's
Boozler.
Old.
Get the baby
He's
from the
tired.
Commercials to be his co-host.
Let us go and thank our panel, Ray Graff, David Gustina, and, of course, Rosemary Armeo. We would love to hear from you as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, sure.
Thank
no
you,
problem.
Joe.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.